are listening to the Elephant in the Room podcast with your host, Sutta Singh. Each week, we will bring you a diverse range of inspiring speakers on issues of inequality and inequity. You will hear stories about fairness, justice, belonging, and about best practice for creating a more inclusive workplace. So, if you are an individual or leader interested in a fairer, equitable, compassionate society and workplace, this podcast is for you.
My guest on the Elephant in the Room podcast, Dr. Doyin Atevolugun, is an honorary fellow of Trinity College. She's the former director of Gender Leadership and Inclusion Center at Cranfield School of Management. Dr. Doyin is also an academic advisor on the Parker Steering Committee led by Sir John Parker into ethnic diversity on FTSE 350 boards. Thank you, Dr. Doyin, for being a guest on the Elephant in the Room podcast today.
Let's start with a bit about your childhood and education and what prepared you for the journey that you are on today.
Thank you, Sutta. A real pleasure to be here. So I am speaking to you from the UK. I have lived in the UK for many years, over 25 years. But I was born in Nigeria, and I often say that I lived and absolutely embraced my life in Nigeria. And when I moved to the UK at about age 17, that's when I realized I was Black. Growing up, in terms of my childhood and my education, I had a great family, a loving family, an extended family. Both my parents were professionals. We were like third generation university educated. I went to a really good school. My brother went to a private school. I went to one of those old, you know, like colonial legacy schools. Therefore, had very good education and had many people in my life who were successful, you know, in all sorts of ways. So there was no question about kind of like talent or reaching your capacity or your potential. And in one of those conversations with different people, I found out about psychology. I found out because my auntie is a psychologist, and I didn't know what psychology was then, but she said, oh, it's about people and you understand people. And I said, oh, I love people. And so that, again, you know, beyond interest and passion, I thought was great. So that was the first like phase of my life. I'll just spend just a few moments just talking a little bit more about how that evolved over time in terms of later education. So I was very interested in psychology, and I was able to study psychology at university and do a master's in psychology at work because I was interested in how people make sense of work. And then I became very curious, like I said, when I moved to the UK and started understanding what it means to be yourself at work or to be your best self at work. I just started asking questions based on my experiences and other people's experiences and my observations about your being able to bring your best self to work differs depending on who you are and how the environment sees you. And so therefore, I was very interested in understanding the psychology of difference. And in some ways, those are some of the key experiences or phases that brought me to where I am now.
The stepping stones. What is your view on the heightened interest in DEI by individuals, organizations, and governments in 2020?
Gosh, it feels like the first time for some people, doesn't it? Yeah. But you know what? I think it's more of a spotlighting of what is already there, what is already present. And I know when we, in many conversations, we talk about how the pandemic has shifted things. Because the pandemic has taken us back indoors, we don't have many different experiences, whereas rich as the experiences as we had. So we're all focusing on the same data, the same images, the same stories, and therefore spotlighting events that have always been there, we just didn't notice. So my view is it might feel like the first time for some, but it's more of a spotlighting and an evolution of the way in which we need to really pay attention to inequalities around us.
So beautifully explained, Doyin. As a psychologist, what do you think is the root cause of racism And are human beings inherently racist?
Yeah, it's so funny you ask this, because in December 2020 in the UK on the news was information about the government dismissing the view that unconscious bias is worth spending their time on. So they were like, nope, we're not going to do any unconscious bias training. I talk about this because unconscious bias is one of those really heavy, deeply psychological concepts. Unconscious bias is essentially the idea that we carry around with us thoughts, behaviors, attitudes of which we're not consciously aware. We don't bring it to our mind, but it influences the way in which we respond to people. And so, for example, some of the things that we might find is when we are in a meeting and someone with a deep voice speaks, we pay closer attention and are a little bit more likely to be influenced by what they say, because we have an association between manliness and certain like deep voices and knowing the right thing. But having said that, there is a strong psychological basis for how we respond to difference. I do want to acknowledge, because it's very important, that the origins of racism actually lie in a very conscious economic strategy. It was very explicit. I think it was the 1600s, sometime in the 1600s when it started, where in Europe, I think it was Portugal, essentially there was a desire that we need capital, we want to get wealthy off labor, and a way to get cheap labor is to buy and sell people. So it was a financial economic reason. And yes, since then, lots of things have happened such that without knowing it, our world is organized according to different colors, and we treat people based on their different colors in different ways, and we may not know about it. I think it's important to acknowledge that it came about from a conscious intention to separate people and make money from it.
Wow, that's such awesome perspective and insight. I didn't know that at all. What is the impact of COVID-19, Black Lives Matter, economic slowdown in exacerbating inequalities in society?
Just to go back to my point around spotlighting what's already there. So spotlighting, but maybe in some ways exacerbating, making worse. So there's a couple of things. We know for many different reasons, including economics, but also culture, that if you live in the UK, certainly, and I think this is probably the same in other parts of the world where they've gathered the data, that if you live in a multi-generational household, i.e., for example, you live, you know, grandchildren and grandparents in a close family setting, number one, and if you live with more people than average, you know, again, if we think culturally, it is much more likely that if you're from an immigrant community or from a minority ethnic background, you're much more likely to draw on those family resources, pay attention to your grandparents, and also live together. And unfortunately, when we think of what we know about the pandemic, is that it spreads through people, people loving each other, people hugging each other, people living together. So this is one way, just one way. There are many other ways, but one way in which the pandemic has a differential impact or disproportionate impact on people who come from a minority ethnic community. But the other thing, and I think this is you and I, you are in your location, I'm in a different location, we're using technology. We are in some ways, even though we're both women of color, we also work in a context where we are professionals, and based on our own kind of social class, we're able to do our work virtually. So we are more protected in some ways because we can get our income even by staying at home. But when we think about other members of the minority ethnic community, or just more broadly, when we think about class, we know that there are people who don't have a choice, who have to go out and work in service roles, service industries, cleaners, people who might be cleaning or driving buses, etc. So in some ways, some people are more protected than others. And I think when we think about COVID, in addition to, like I said, spotlighting technology, everybody can now see videos of police brutality, of riots and all of that. There's also actually, when we think about how we live and how different people have different exposure in terms of different lifestyles, how it just makes it tougher for particular people and perpetuates some of the inequalities.
In 2019, numbers for female meds was at an all-time high at 32.8%, but the percentage of female executive directors still very low. What is the likely explanation for this wide discrepancy?
Well, thank you for introducing that topic. When we think through the progress that we need to make at this level, we need to remember that there's two sources of talent. For example, when we look at non-executive director level, the vast majority of positions are external. So the pool is much broader. And the other advantage that we have, and I'm using advantage in air quotes, is that the same woman, for example, can take up multiple roles and fill in the gender balance for different organizations. So some, and I would probably be one of those people, would say that actually it's quote unquote easier for some companies or some boards or some executive search firms to work towards gender balance by looking at NEDs. When we look within your organization, at your pipeline, at your director level, your senior manager level, what are you doing within your business? There are barriers that organizations have put into play in terms of, for example, assumptions that the only people who can do this job have to show up in the office from, 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. And in fact, I know a lot of us are saying this, that the pandemic has completely disrupted that. So to explain the differences, it is because we need to do a lot more within the organization to release the talent that's in the pipeline.
I think people are very confused and they feel very good about that NED numbers, but it's not something to be too pleased about. We know now that it is impossible to meet the 1 by 2021 target. Why do the FTSE 100 perform so badly on ethnic diversity on boards?
Oh, Sadhari, you're making it tricky now. You're putting people on the spot. This is great. Thank you for that question. And for listeners, Sudhir is referring to the Parker Review, which is the review that I've been involved in. It's a government-backed review that focuses on ethnicity on the FTSE-listed companies in the UK. And the target or strap line that we used when we kicked off a few years ago was 1 by 21. But of course, we kicked off, I think it was about 2016, 2017. And here we are, 2021 is a matter of a couple of weeks away. And Sudhir is saying, okay, so what's happened? I think on one hand, I'm not as discouraged as I think many people would be. I only say that because based on the work that we've done on the gender diversity on boards, it was a little bit of a slow start. It really was. Although some people listening might say, well, that was 4 years ago, really. How slow is the start? So I take that. But the work for many of us listening on the call, we know that the work for gender equality has been ongoing for many would say for a number of decades, even if we're just looking at gender equality in the workplace, many, many decades. So on one hand, I am saying that the research suggests that it took us a little while to just get into it when we thought about gender. And then there was a real quick, a very rapid movement. So I'm hopeful that if we think through that trajectory, that it will be a similar basis or similar experience. And certainly the events of the summer, I think in many ways, might be the impetus that some people are looking for.
Do you believe that legislation is a route to equity?
I think it's an important placeholder, with regards to being clear on what our minimal standards are. think legislation is important to say, you know what, this is the minimum required to meet, i.e. no discrimination on the grounds of ABCD. But we do want to do more. We do want to aspire. We don't want to just have no discrimination. We actually want to be conscious and mindful about inclusion, about making sure that we all are not just free from discrimination, but actually we have opportunities to bring our full selves to work.
Yeah, because a lot of people believe that legislation is the route to equity. But like you explained, legislation is the base.
It's the base. It is the base. Yeah. I mean, it may be actually, Sudha, that there's something around, maybe we need to be more creative in terms of our legislation. But if we looked at the law right now, that is essentially what it says. And we can't just be satisfied with, okay, do not discriminate against.
Do you subscribe to the view that targets are essential for progress? How do we hold leaders accountable?
Yes, so I think in addition to legislation, so to go back as we think through what are the different levers, what are the different things that people need to work with, I'm of the view that targets are in the, yes, let us implement targets category. And I say that partly as a psychologist, right? Targets, they help focus, they quantify, you can measure. As human beings, when we think through behavior change, one of the things we know from behavior and motivation is goals work. Setting a goal for human beings gets them to act. So,
yes.
Of course, you need to think about how you communicate. Of course, you need to do that in addition to other things. But one of the things actually that some of your listeners might benefit from is the 2020 Cranfield report on the female FTSE. So we just call it the female FTSE report. We do it every year. The 2020 report has a piece on whether targets work and how targets work. So there's some research there that's up to date where some of my colleagues looked at different organizations to ask them about targets and some of the pros and cons of that. So I think readers, and you can possibly put it in your notes as well.
Yeah, I'll put it in the show notes, and I'm looking forward to reading it myself. I'd read the previous one, so it's very interesting. Mm-hmm. I read about the Women to Watch, which is a list of 50 inspiring female leaders from Black, Asian, and other minority ethnic backgrounds suitable for board positions. The title is self-explanatory, but could you elaborate on the need for such a list?
Indeed. So I said a few moments ago that the work on gender equality is something that we compare when we look at the work on ethnic equality. So yes, we are not there yet in terms of parity for women at senior levels. We're not there yet. But often when we think about gender diversity at senior levels, many of us often think about a particular type of woman. We don't really think about different types of women. So when we pulled together the Women to Watch list, it was like a special edition, so to speak. We said, you know what, we have had 10 years of spotlighting about 1,000 women. And we thought, actually, this year, let's focus specifically on women of color so that we can uplift and showcase all of the talent there, because we don't necessarily think of women of color across sectors as potential. Many of us, particularly executive search firms, don't consciously think, let me look through a list and actually, hey, where are the women of color here? So we thought we'd make it easy for people to access.
I've seen that list. It's a fantastic list of women in all senior positions. So yeah, no excuses from recruiters or those who say there are not enough senior women of color around.
Indeed, exactly.
Is the ethnicity pay gap a panacea for the systemic inequalities in society and business?
Oh, it's not. Again, I think that's another useful lever to pull. An ethnicity pay gap helps us quantify, helps us, depending on how sophisticated our analyses are, help us understand maybe where the challenges are, and if we at least focus on providing some sort of balance or equitable experience in terms of income, then we are contributing in some ways to fairness and equality in some ways. But there's so much more that we need to do. All sorts in terms of education, in terms of criminal justice, in terms of access to healthcare. I mean, there are just so many other ways, and that's outside in society. And meanwhile, in organizations, there's like promotion, there is access to mentoring and sponsorship. I mean, there are many other ways in which there are inequalities that we need to rebalance.
What are the three things organizations can do to be diverse and inclusive? This is our last question, actually.
It is, yeah. So three things. So I would say, at like a basic entry level, what you should do is encourage data collection through self-reporting. Like, just figure out who your people are. And when you do that, when you're asking people to just fill in their data, explain why, explain what you're going to use it for. Because just to go back, many of us, you know, some of us say, if it doesn't get measured, it doesn't get done. If it can't be counted, it doesn't count. I mean, there are many reasons to have that data as a starting point. And my other recommendation with this first point with regards to gathering data is to analyze it intersectionally. And by that, I mean, don't just put your different categories in separate boxes. So say, well, you know what, we have these men, these women, we have these people with a reported disability, we have these people who don't, we have this proportion of people who are of these various ethnic groups. Do what you can to combine that. For example, if you can, combine your data around gender with your data around ethnicity. And that gives you a richer picture of what's happening in your business. So that's the first thing they can do. The second thing I would encourage is remember that we all in our society and we all in our organization have a role to play. When we think about diversity and inclusion, it's not just for HR, or it's not just for people of color, or it's not just for the LGBTQ community, the lesbian, gay, bisexual, trans, and queer community in your organization. No, it's for all of us. And so one of the things that I do in the work that I do is I talk about involving the whole inclusion ecosystem. So we might say, if we're working to diversify leadership from an ethnicity perspective, we might say, okay, we will work with people of color in a particular level in the organization, you know, the senior managers, to help them think through coaching or, like, you know, a kind of understanding what it means to be an authentic leader. But in addition to that, we'll work with the senior leaders in the organization about being mentors, about being advocates, about being champions. And then we would also say, actually, we'll also work with your line managers to understand how they themselves might be perpetuating bias. So it's about working with different people in the system in order for it to change. And really, my third point broadly is around, while you focus on data and you focus on the people, you also need to focus on the practices and the processes. That means, even if you're convinced that nobody is being biased and nobody is treating anyone differently, if you see that there are different outcomes, then there's something in your process that's going wrong. There's something, for example, in terms of how you've defined what leadership looks like in your leadership framework that is advantaging some people and disadvantaging others.
That's fantastic. That's detailed and specific at the same time. I know I said that was my last question, but can I just ask you one more? And that is to do with BAME, B-A-M-E, B-M-E. I couldn't let you go without asking that one.
Indeed, indeed. So your question is, what do I think? What is my take on BME versus BAME? Okay. So, no, indeed. Oh, no, I have an opinion. Don't worry, Sada. I have an opinion. I'm going to introduce a concept called social construct in this conversation. A social construct is a thing that is not real, that's not tangible. We cannot hold on to it. It's not hard. It is something that all of us through our language, through our ideas, through, you know, just through our experience, we create meaning for. It's not a real thing. It is real, but only real in our heads. The identities and labels are social constructs. They are terminologies that we use because they work messily, inappropriately, but kind of give us an idea of what we are looking for at that point in time. So therefore, we will never, I'm sure, be 100% satisfied with what terminology we use to describe people on the basis of something that actually doesn't really exist, which is race. Race doesn't exist, but we arrange ourselves and organize ourselves in a way that it exists. So therefore, my position is always, you know what, there will never be one term that everybody's happy with. But then I say, think about the population you're working with. So if I'm working with an organization and I have time, I might say, what do you prefer in your company to use, and use that term, but understand that that term, not everyone in that organization would be happy with it. And even if they are, if you go to another organization, it will mean completely different. So I tend to use, you've heard me on this call, I've turned to use people of color, but again, I know absolutely that there will be people listening to you who are like, what? Why is she using that? And I'm like, it's a social construct.
What a fantastic way to end this podcast, this conversation. Thank you so much, Doyen. It's been an absolute pleasure and a learning experience for me.
It's been a pleasure, Sita. Thank you so much for the invitation.
Thank you for joining us this week on the Elephant in the Room podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to the show on any of your favorite platforms, iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts. And if you enjoyed listening to the podcast today, don't forget to write a review and tell your friends. Sign up on the link in the show notes to receive updates on our guest speakers, blogs, and events. And don't forget to tune in every Thursday for new episodes.